Accession number 11938, reel 47.
Mr. G. Eisen, reel 47. You've been in quite a number of actions, Mr. Eisen, by this stage of the war. Did you ever see the results of shell shock, or battle fatigue, as it's called now?
Well, on numerous occasions. But this is something that a soldier doesn't like to think too much about, because it's a fear, like a fear of heights, which is something that you can't control. And then there could be the genuine shell shock, where a shell has landed close to a person, he's gone deaf, possibly blind, concussion, which is actually the concussion which has caused that one. There's another one like the lad I mentioned in France, a corporal from C Company, who had his cheek blown off. That lad, he just went berserk. He wanted to be sticking his bayonet into Germans. He didn't want to go back at all. He wanted to be sticking his bayonet into Germans and getting his own back. And then there are a number of occasions where you get the occasional wimp. A man who has just lost his nerve. There's always the story of Patton with the bloke who lost his nerve, and he thumped him. And in some occasions, Patton could have been right. I mean, I've seen this happen, and there's some cases where a lad wants a good thump and shake him up and let him give him another pain to think about rather than his own fears. And another case where he's genuinely shocked and doesn't know what he's doing. His brain is more or less gone. There's another case where a lad is just shaking and he couldn't have fired a rifle if you held it for him. He couldn't have pulled the trigger because he was just too shattered. These are more or less cases of shell shock. There is another thing where I've already mentioned, I think, of the two lads who shot their big toes off before they went out the Middle East. But they were carried on board in stretchers. They didn't get away with that one. What happened to them eventually, I don't know. They went on the stretchers and were put straight inside as soon as they got on the ship. I don't know, there's so many different forms of this, which is bad really to try and generalise it, because every case, I think the doctors would tell you that every case is different, and the cause of the case in a lot of different cases are different. The worst one, I think, is the genuine shell shock, where a shell has landed close at hand and the ears have gone and possibly the eyes have gone, and he is concussed because of the explosion.
If a man's nerve goes and his comrades are around him, does that have an adverse effect upon the morale of the people immediately around him?
I don't think so. We've had cases where a man has had to be held down, physically held down, similar to Corporal Charlie out of C Company. He had to be forcibly detained and taken away. And there's another case where the limbs are physically moving, and he just lost control of his limbs. He's such a nervous state that he has no control of his legs, and he's kicking and shouting and riving. And that can be naughty, because he could attract enemy, if he's in close combat, he could attract enemy fire or even grenades. So then I think what would happen then, that he would get a good thump and possibly he might even get more serious treatment if he was endangering in life.
By more serious treatment, what do you mean by that?
He'd be shot. You see, you can't endanger 13 people in a section, well, 10 men in a section or 9 men in a section, whatever sections are. You can't endanger 9 men for the sake of one man. And if it gets to that stage, I think the corporal or a consensus of opinion would do something about it. They would be physically restrained if at all possible.
Now, do you know,
and I can't honestly recall anybody being shot in that sort of situation.
Was the immediate response then to take them out of the position?
Oh, definitely.
And get them away.
Get them away, because they're a danger to everybody. They're a danger to themselves, and they're a danger to the comrades, because they don't know what they're going to do. And their comrades don't know what they're going to do. So, yes, the thing is to get them away as sharp as possible. If you can. I mean, it's not always possible.
What was the men's response to this? Was it compassionate? Did they understand what was happening?
I think in most cases, yes. It all depends on the man. If he's an arrogant type, which some were, and very often they were, funnily enough, it was very often an arrogant one who went that way, because they're overhyped, I would say today. We talk of people being hyped up, and I would say that the arrogant people intend to be overhyped. And this is a dangerous situation. Because, I mean, he's only got to expose himself. And the enemy realise that there's somebody there. You might only see the one man who's exposed himself. But the enemy knows there's people there, and a mortar bomb is very easily lobbed over onto one man. And then you've lost a full section, or possibly a platoon. So, it's not taught, this. I mean, it is common sense. And the soldier uses his own common sense about it. I can't say that people were shot. I have explained before that there was a collusion between the officer and the sergeant. And let's be fair, no sergeant really wants to see his own men, because it's degrading to him. He hasn't trained the man properly, you might say, and no unit wants this sort of thing to happen, because it's bad for the image of the unit. So there's a great toleration, but toleration will only go so far. And if there's a danger to more than himself, I think he'd be taken out, quite honestly.
Going into a major action, were there arrangements to have battlefield police or someone like that at the back in case of stragglers or people not doing what they should do?
Well, it was always understood that the platoon sergeant was the whipper in. The officer led the attack, and the section corporals, the section commanders, they were always sort of leading their section. And the sergeant was at the back, he was the whipper in. So the CSM was the whipper in for the company. The RSM was the whipper in for the battalion. So you've always got this at the back. The only difference was, with us in most cases, we found that in a really serious situation like Mirza Matru and at Colonel Battiscombe's episode, the RSM led the attack, because he's an officer. In fact, he's better equipped than most of the officers that are on the go, because the officers are named mainly young fellas, more or less straight from college. So, yes, you've got these whippers in all the way through. And I can't recall if people have been charged with cowardice and running away from the enemy. Certainly there's very harsh words said at times. Why did he do this? For instance, in my own situation, when I left the truck at Mazrus, I was more or less accused of leaving a good vehicle, which wasn't, because I shouldn't have taken the vehicle in the first place. So, yes, those harsh words said. In my case, I didn't quite agree with it, to be quite honest, but that's the way it was. And I think there's always this situation where a person, especially the first time he goes into action, doesn't know what it's all about. It can sound so much worse than it really is. I did talk about the tracer bullets. I mean, you can see a tracer bullet which falls short. It doesn't do the full distance. But you've got to remember that there's 10 or possibly more that's going the full distance, which is probably coming quite close to you. And it does look much worse or sounds much worse, I would say, rather than looks. Because you don't see the 10 that's going to come to you. You only see the trace that drops short. That is why In the case of Tunisia, after on Fayetteville, we thought we'd have done the next jog and clear Tunis. And I think the majority of us would thought at that particular time that we'd clear Tunis, and having done 2 years and nearly 3 years abroad, we'd go back home. But wisely enough, when you think about it, I don't know, was it Montgomery or the Corps commander, Lise, decided the 56th Div should come in from Iraq. And the 56th Div relieved us in, I think it was 10 Corps at that particular time. It'd be hard, wouldn't it? The 56th Div came in to be bloodied. You know, and we were sent back to the Delta, which was a bit of a disappointment. But you know, it was right enough that they should come in and be bloodied on a winning situation, which are two very different things. Like Alice was a winning situation, or at the start it was anyway. And we were hyped up, you know, we thought it was great in a sense. Well, there was a few falling around us, right enough, but we realised that was war. But if we had gone into action at Mersey, mine, of course, we'd had a long spell. We'd had 5 months at Gazala and then Tobruk and Marus and then into Mersey. I think if that had been my first action, it could have been very different, because that was nasty. There's nothing nice. Let's not kid ourselves. There's nothing nice, but to go into a really serious situation first, I think must be morale is down to start with, and then to be fired at and shelled and bombed. I think that must be a bad situation. So, for all we were very disheartened about going back to the Delta after on Fayetteville, we can see now that the Blood 56 Div in a winning situation was much better than possibly dropping on straight into the Northern Europe.
When you left Marus, where was your next place? What was your next action?
Well, we went back out the line slightly, and we did this inspection by Lise. And he told us that we'd done a good job, which we did, as I explained in a few tapes ago, that it wasn't a complete defeat. It was actually a win when he took the whole front as a complete thing. And then we relieved the guards. The guards had become part of 52 at this particular time, and they stayed with us until on Fayetteville, the guards brigade. Yes, because we moved through them at Fayetteville. We went to relieve them because they'd been in action from the 16th of March, 10 days of continual action to try and get into the bastion and beyond. They had a fair amount of losses, and early the next morning, this was on the 27th of March, the carriers went out to start their patrolling, and the enemy had gone. And the squeeze had come in from the New Zealanders going around Elama and towards Gabies. And the following morning of the 27th, the night after we went in, they'd gone. So we followed up to Marath South, South Marath, a beautiful spot in olive groves, a typical Foreign Legion oasis situation where you could stand on the top of the fort and look away out across to the sea and away down the hills, the Matmahara Hills, Matmata Hills, and it was a really beautiful spot, and we stayed there two or three days. The vehicles caught up with us, because the vehicles had been back from the actual action at Arras, you know, the B echelon had been back.
Marath.
Yes, they'd been left back from Marath. This is still Marath, but we'd been out 4 days, I think. And then we relieved the guards. And the night after we went in, the enemy fled. So we hadn't got our vehicles all together by then. And we spent another short while here cleaning up the battlefront. And a burial party went off to Oesa and Ksibi, where we'd done the attack. And they were sort of getting the tags and identifying the dead and burying them.
Were you in on one of these?
No. It's probably as well, because we had one killed and two wounded on this on the party that went out. They'd gone to pick the bodies up and they were booby-trapped. That did cause some I don't know what you call it, an anxiety, an upset anyway, a very bad feeling that they would mine, put booby traps and mines around these bodies that were left in the battlefield. That time to put the mines and the booby traps with them time before they left. You know, that did cause some very bad feeling. We had quite a few pleasant days there, because we weren't too far from the sea. We could get down our quick bath. You see, bathing was always a problem. There was I don't remember seeing any baths the way we had in France and the way they had them in the First World War. And the situation was much worse, really, because in a lot of places you couldn't get water. You couldn't get to the sea. But in this place, it wasn't too far, and it could easily put a few blocks into a truck and away down to the sea. And it was very pleasant. Very pleasant. Not a lot of civilians around. There's a few civilians around, but not very many.
You must have lost quite a lot of men.
Yes. There's quite a lot came up, really. Just at the moment, I can't just recall any, but there was quite a lot of reinforcements coming through. I did mention the last tape, just how many men we'd got. I think we're down to 169 all told at one particular time. But of course, a lot came back. They'd been captured and got away again, and so we got quite a lot back from the field, and some very lightly wounded. They turned back. I have explained that it took if you were away 6 weeks, then you went back to the holding unit and started off again. Well, we had a visit from the new Brigadier Senior, and told us politely that we wouldn't be long before we're in action again. And on the 4th of April, we moved up to Elmo, for Wadi Akarit. That was 15 miles northwest of Marath. It's where the next natural line is from the hills running from east to west, and then there's a short spell of coast. The Tunisian coast, it varies such a lot in the coastal plain. At Gabies, which was just beyond Marath, it was quite wide, but it ran into a salt marsh. And that chot was over 2,000 square miles, as big as Devon. And it ran right from a thin strip on the coast at Wadi Zigzag, and then it branched out and spread out and went right on the other border of Tunisia. But there at Gabies there was quite a wide plain, about 30 miles wide from the sea to the foothills. But at Wadi Akrit it got down to about 10 miles, and was now their ideal place for Manati tank ditch and all the rest of it. The 69th Brigade were doing the attack there, the 50th Div part of it, and we were going as a reserve battalion for 69th Brigade on that particular night. And the attack went quite well with the 69th Brigade and then the Ireland Division on the right, on the coast side of it. But it made, as they, in the morning came, and they found they were 1,000 yards apart. They'd gone up either side of the Hakana Ridge.
This is a ridge?
A ridge, yes. And 51st Division had sort of gone low on the east side of it, and the 69th Brigade had gone low on the west side of it, so it was a 1,000-yard gap over the top of the hills. And of course, in the morning, we were told to push our way through and fill this gap. One battalion for 1,000 yards is a bit of a tall order, especially as the enemy was still on the high ground. However, we did eventually get there, and it was a terrible job, because to get the carriers up, we had to sort of put one man in front, and the carrier followed that man, because the tracks were just that wide. And then, you see, as I've explained, mid the ridge, there was still the sides of the ridge where the enemy could have been dug in, and in one or two cases there were. There wasn't a lot of difficulty, really. But it was the fact that it was just this narrow ridge, and we had to get the carriers up and the mortars, and the men sort of clambered over the ridges as far as they can. Quite steep it was at the either side of it, and stony. It wasn't a soft moor-like hill. It was a granite, well, not granite, but a stone ridge.
And had the Germans very largely gone?
They'd largely gone. The 69th had done, the two battalions had done this attack and gone forward, but they'd left the 1,000-yard gap over the top of the hill. And in fact, it was so bad that on the night we put our attack in.
Do you recall the date?
Yeah, we went on the 8th. On the night of the 8th.
8th of May.
8th of April. April. And it was so tight that we were just having serious problems with wirelesses. I think I did explain this a little bit before, but the CO and the battalion headquarters had what we call a 19 set with a fairly high antenna or mast. And then we were using a carrier with an even higher mast. Attached to it, as high as we could get it, to go back to brigade, which had a very high mast with stays out and all the rest of it. I mean, our masts or antennae, they were portable, but brigade had a fairly solid thing with guy ropes and all the rest of it, so they were fairly high. But the problem was to get the carrier mast between the two sets so that it could pick up from one set and relay to another one. And unfortunately, we tried to do it that fine that he went over the side. We were very lucky, nobody hurt, but we lost the carrier. It was just impossible to get it back again. And now there's nobody hurt. It's unbelievable. But that's the sort of situation we were in. And we didn't have much trouble. There was a fair amount of rifle fire and a little bit of machine gun fire and a few mortar shells. But really speaking, there was no defence at all. And by 9 o'clock in the morning, the army was getting up over the track and moving through fairly fast. And they were giving chase. The enemy had gone. There was one good thing about this, that we got our new B Company blooded. We hadn't had a B Company since Gazara, I believe it was. And we'd got a new B Company just at Marath. After Marath, we got a new B Company. And we were up to four companies again, a depleted company. I think there was only about 100... anyway, they were depleted. I think there were about 60 in each company. But we had the four companies, and they'd been bloodied, all the new lads had...
Where were they coming from?
From the... well, I think they mainly came from Geneva, in the Delta, which was the infantry reinforcement depot.
And were the infantry men that were coming?
Oh, yes. Not all Durhams, by any means, but they were infantry men. And unfortunately, they weren't all light infantry men. Most of them were, but not all of them were light infantry men. Which caused one or two bits of snags when we were doing these parades, that they weren't all up to infantry, the light infantry standard of arms drill and things like that. Anyway, they'd been shelled and had a few mortar bombs and snipers slung at them, and they'd been bloodied without the problem of a bayonet attack, which to me is really one of the worst things a man can be forced to do. It's not. I'm very fortunate I never had to do it, but I suppose I would have done if the situation had arisen. As you know, at Arras, I went out without my rifle, never mind the bayonet.
What was your role in this particular action? What were you doing?
To get the vehicles that were being used for the attack, to get them in position, like the carrier with the mast and the mortars and the anti-tank guns up so that they could cover the front. Now, the anti-tank guns, they had a terrific job there, and really you'll have to try and get some of these anti-tank lads to dwell on this situation a little bit, because for them to get their guns into a situation where they could have repelled a counterattack on these ridges and in among all the stones, they must have had a terrific job. I mean, there was just the width of a vehicle, of a track. It was only a bridle track at the best of times. And to get a vehicle up there and then unload the anti-tank gun and sling it in position, because by now we're on 6-pounders, which is a little bit heavier than the 2-pounder. I mean, the 2-pounder, if you had enough men, you could almost carry it. If you stripped it down a bit, you could almost carry it. But the 6-pounder was a different kettle of fish. And they had a terrific job. The mortars weren't so bad, because the mortar can be, the 3-inch mortar, it can be carried on the back for well, they have been carried for some long distances, but it's only a short distance job, really. You see, the mortar ammunition is terrifically heavy, and that sort of... you don't want to be too far away from your carrier, because that's where your mortar shells are, and if you're using mortar shells, you're carrying some weight to keep them going. And the same with the Brens, of course. When you start using ammunition on the Brens, you're carrying some weight to keep them going.
I gather from what you say that your role seems to be one of advanced fitter, you might say. We're
That's
always
right.
Travelling with the early vehicles.
That's right. I was what they called an A echelon fitter. An A echelon was the fighting vehicles. Anything that I couldn't... My brief was, in a static situation, anything I couldn't repair in half an hour went back to B echelon. On the move, anything I couldn't repair in 5 minutes, we fired. If we were in, unless we're advancing, of course. If we're advancing, you would leave it and hope that somebody else was going to pick it up. But if you're in retreat, my instructions were that it should be fired, which was the case in the case I didn't do when I left the truck at Russ.
Were you briefed before these actions, these individual actions?
No, that was some difficulty. I didn't go to the briefings I didn't go to the CO's briefing of what he, the CO's orders, as it's called, his battle orders. And sometimes I sort of thought that maybe I should have done, because there was a case when we were moving up to Marath, where in one, in fact, we did it twice. We did it one day and then we did it again the next day. And I mean, I was completely at a loss there because I had no idea really what had happened. I mean, at that particular time, we were travelling across country and there was no... once they'd gone, I mean, I could out of sight completely. And this was a bit of a problem. Generally speaking, I knew what probably the S Company commander would tell me, or the maybe their quarter company commander would tell me. Generally, when I was on a breakdown in any of the companies, the company commander would come along and see what the situation was, because his vehicles, if he didn't have his vehicles, he had to have manpower to move the stuff off the vehicles. And so he was always very worried